Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, honoring Arbor Day on April 26th, with an ongoing commitment to sustainable stewardship and conservation of Missouri's forests. ChooseWood.com.
As a journalist, Sylvester Brown continues to understand the world around him through his brilliantly relatable, fictional characters. Are you a Sal or a Saul?
Well, Sal was a conservative brother. He was the one that didn't have time for black power talk and didn't have time for revolution or revelation. He was strictly, you know, black folks have a role in this society. You do what you're supposed to do. You shut up and you do your job. Whereas Saul was this older, not militant, but proud black man who knew his history and always stood up for, you know, black folks.
And it seems like there's no escaping creepy old Uncle Ray, that's short for Uncle Racism.
He takes many forms. You know, I haven't written about him, but I have been tempted to write about him during the Trump years because to me, Ray came back, and he came back in all kinds of different guises, not just, you know, the Southern truck-driving, flag-waving, you know, guy. He was a banker. He was a lawyer. He was a doctor. He was, you know, Ray had resurfaced.
I'm Sarah Fenske. This is St. Louis on the Air. Sylvester Brown Jr. has been up and he's been down. He was on top of the world, or at least his hometown, as a Metro columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And then he was down and out, feeling demeaned and micromanaged, and then fired in what he felt to be a gross overreaction. But he found his way back to journalism and much more. Brown's new story collection compiles pieces from 1995 to 2018, and so it gets into those lows and those highs, along with context to illuminate them. It also introduces newer readers to some of the fictional characters that he features in his nonfiction, people who might be real, but strictly speaking, aren't. The book is titled White Castles with Jesus and Uncle Ray at the Used Tire Shop, and joining us today to talk about it is Sylvester Brown. Sylvester, welcome.
Well, hello, Sarah. How are you?
So I'm so excited to talk to you today. And one of the things I want to talk about is this technique you use in your column writing. Some people might think fictional characters fall in the realm of fake news, but there's actually a long history of newspaper columnists using people who don't really exist to explore the way we live. I grew up reading Mike Royko. He had a boyhood friend named Slat Skrobnik who didn't really exist. Who was your inspiration for this technique?
Mine was Langston Hughes in the late 80s, early 90s, attorney J. Justin Meehan, introduced me to Langston Hughes' character, Just Be Simple. He used it in his columns for the Chicago Defender.
And this was back in the 1940s, is that right?
I believe it was, yeah. Between 1940s and early 1960, I think he kept them going that long. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, what about this resonated with you?
It was liberating to me. You know, I was just entering the game, just started my newspaper, and I was, you know, following the format of strict, you know, columnist, commentator format. And then I read Hughes' stories and how he used Jess, you know, to address social issues, religious issues, political issues. And, you know, it wasn't just Be Simple. He had a whole bunch of characters around that. And just the way he did it and his use of words and skills and people's verbal norms, all that stuff fascinated me. Mm-hmm. So I started playing around with that back then.
And you memorably played around with it over the years with these two characters named Sal and Saul. Tell us about these guys.
You know, so growing up, you know, in the poor neighborhoods I was in, there were always black men. There were griots. They were, you know, they were preachers. They were shade tree mechanics. They were guys on the corner just drinking and talking smack. So Saul and Sal are a combination, a culmination of all those older black men who influenced me as a child. You know, I would listen to their stories and listen to their advice and how they bantered back and forth and rarely agreeing on anything and just how animated and colorful they were in those conversations. So they stayed with me. So it was really wonderful to be able to use Saul and Sal, the guys at the used tire shop. And there was a real used tire shop in my neighborhood. So just to use them to talk about all the issues that was banging around in my head and throughout my life, again, was liberating and fun, actually.
And you write that a lot of your white readers at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, they sided with Sal. What did Sal stand for?
Well, Sal was a conservative brother. He was the one that didn't have time for black power talk and didn't have time for revolution or revelation. He was strictly, you know, black folks have a role in this society. You do what you're supposed to do. You shut up and you do your job. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I knew and still know a lot of people who are like that. The readers at the Post-Dispatch were introduced to the column, the characters. They always sided on Sal's side, you know, whereas Saul was this older, not militant, but proud black man who knew his history and always stood up for, you know, black folks, always fell on the side of black folks. So they'd had these different little conversations. And Saul was my hero. I mean, I like them both, but Saul was the guy that I related more to.
So Saul really spoke to you. But you also, you let Sal get his points in. He's not just there to be a buffoon. I mean, did they speak to sort of the two voices in your head? It's not just Saul rattling around in there.
Exactly. No, you're actually right. African Americans are not monolithic. We have different opinions. Some of us are very conservative. Some of us are very, you know, activists. And Sal made some very salient points, you know. His conversation about work ethics and black folks moaning all the time, you know, not doing this and not doing that. I mean, those are really valid points. But in context, and that's what I set out to do, was to show that both of these arguments are legitimate. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's up to you to decide who won the debate. I mean, but they both, I think, made a sound and legitimate points.
So one of the columns you include in this story collection, this is White Castles with Jesus and Uncle Ray at the used tire shop. You brought Saul and Sal to your personal blog. This is after the Post-Dispatch fired you. And they're arguing about you. I mean, this is such a personal column. And it was hard for me to read in some ways because I could hear these voices in my own head, the voice telling me, hey, you screwed up a good thing here, you know, after I quit a job, versus the other voice saying, no, you had to do that. You stood firm. Was that your way of just trying to come to terms with whether or not you'd done the right thing in that situation?
That's a great point. And yes, exactly, it was. I was, you know, I felt that I was wrongly fired, and I felt that, you know, I was right, and I felt I ended the way I should have ended it. But on a whole nother level, I was like, man, you lost a damn good job. You lost, you know, your benefits. You lost your vacation, and, you know, your wife is not happy about this, and you got two little girls. And so, yeah, I was beating myself up, and I had to talk my way through it. Maybe I'm a little bit schizophrenic, but I do it publicly. So, yeah, being able to not only go to Saul and Sal, but to write about the conversations in my head that I imagine these two opposing sides would have kind of helped me get through it, you know, helped me realize, yeah, man, you know, it hurt, but here you are. In a weird way, you're in a better position because at the same time, I went to work for Tabitha Smiley's book company at the exact same time that this was going on. So just working through all that and seeing that there was divine wisdom, I guess, in the whole situation helped me move forward. It helped me realize that what happened was really supposed to happen. And you are a better person for it. You know, I was hurt economically, and yeah, I lost the stature and all that stuff, but I mean, I was freed. You know, I could do what I want to do. I could, you know, and this was when Obama was just being elected, and I went to California and Chicago, other places, around this moment of great black movement. And I was free to do it and experienced it on my terms.
So you wrote that before they fired you, you had the clear sense they were gunning for you, that you were being micromanaged in certain ways. And we should say, for people who didn't follow this or don't remember what happened back in the day, you guys ended up having your ultimate falling out. There was an ethical dispute. You had basically accepted the offer of a free trip to Washington, D.C. from supporters of a group you'd previously written about. They found out you'd taken this trip. You said you had no plans to write about it. They said this was a violation of of the ethical policy. They offered to let you go quietly. You said no. You went public with this because you felt strongly that you'd done nothing wrong. But you had felt that even before this, that they were coming after you. And you write in this book about how you felt, quote, small and gray. What was that period like in your life when you kind of felt the boot of the man on the back of your neck?
It was challenging because, you know, before going to the Post-Dispatch, I had my own newspaper and I had my own voice and all that good stuff. And I didn't expect to have that at the Post-Dispatch. But what I was not prepared for was, you know, they made up rules, you know. I mean, write you up for this and do this for that. But yet my colleagues were doing the same things. So I had to go back and forth with the union and have all these letters kicked out of my phone. It was a constant challenge. Then it was what I was writing. Just really strange rules. Like, for example, when the Obama was running for the presidency in 2008, they said, "Stop writing about Obama. You're a Metro columnist. This is a national issue." And me being, you know, the smart person that I am, I invited my editor to take a ride with me to East St. Louis, and I said, "You stop anybody on the street and ask them if this is an important issue to them." So I continued to write about Obama, and they didn't like that. So it was little things. I wasn't that go along to get along brother. I was a guy who really thought, you know, if I was right, I'm going to tell you I'm right, and if I'm wrong, you know, I'll tell you I'm wrong. But it didn't go well. And it was always this micromanaging and questioning and checking. When I'd write articles about Mayor Slay at the time, it was like, well, what does the other younger, whiter reporter think? So it was always this feeling that I wasn't good enough, that I wasn't smart enough, that I wasn't well enough. But I don't want to paint it all as negative because it really wasn't. There were some wonderful people at the Post-Dispatch, great exposure, great platform. But yeah, that eternally it was eating me up. I always felt compromised and I felt small. And so this trip thing, which was so ridiculous, there were three of us, three columnists that were written up on ethics violations at the same time. Me, Bernie Miklas, and Brian Burwell. They were being charged because they had accepted contracts with opposing news stations. I took a trip to Washington, D.C. that I paid for. And they said, now, Brian and Bernie got a slap on the wrist, but they were intent on firing me. It really wasn't. To me, it really wasn't about the issue. It was about, you know, I know they no longer wanted me on the team. So,
do you think race was a big factor in that? The fact they no longer wanted you on the team and the fact that they kept coming at you with these rules that didn't seem to apply to colleagues?
What was going on at that time? This was the mid-2009. Mm-hmm. And they were just under a whole lot of pressure from opposing, from Fox News and all these other conservative channels that were making millions and millions of dollars and siphoning advertising money from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. So they were really trying to appease their red state readers, the subscribers. And at the time when they fired me, they actually had a clandestine campaign going out to certain zip codes, which actually, in the journalism review wrote about this, they had a campaign that was going out to certain zip codes that were saying, "We're not as liberal as you think." So I just think I became a pain in their ass, excuse me. I think they just wanted to, you know, get rid of the guy who was ultra-liberal and ultra-black. And, you know, I just wish they had did that. I just wish they had fired me instead of just coming up with this bogus charge, which was, in the context of who was charged, mine was the least egregious.
We're talking today to Sylvester Brown Jr. He's a longtime St. Louis journalist. His new story collection is White Castles with Jesus and Uncle Ray at the Used Tire Shop. And Sylvester, I asked you there about racism, and that leads us right into another fictional character who's maybe not so fictional that we need to talk about today, and that is the titular Uncle Ray. In this case, Uncle Ray is short for Uncle Racism, and you compare him to St. Louis's crazy old uncle. Tell us what led you to this idea of Uncle Ray as racism in the flesh.
You know, I found myself always talking about racism and cursing out racism, and actually wondering how did this idea that one race based on skin color is superior to the other. How did it become so powerful? How did it become so institutionalized? How did it become, you know, so structural? So I always questioned that. But then at one point, you know, something happened when I first wrote about it, and it made me actually actually curse racism. So I went from that to actually he became a character to me. He became this dirty, nasty, filthy, decrepit old man, and that I could really discuss and curse and argue with. So I introduced him when I had Take Five magazine, I think in 87 or 91, I forget. But he also followed me to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And actually, I talked to Uncle Ray 2 weeks ago when Washington, D.C. was under siege. And once again, I found myself saying, how the hell did you think that you could overtake the Capitol? You know, what's wrong with you, Ray?
and what was Ray thinking? Is Ray no longer sentient?
I don't know. Ray's always been mad. Let's not get that. He's always been crazy.
Yeah.
But he's powerful crazy, and he takes many forms. You know, I haven't written about him, but I have been tempted to write about him during the Trump years, because to me, Ray came back, and he came back in all kinds of different guises. He was not just, you know, the Southern truck driving, flag waving, you know, guy. He was a banker. He was a lawyer. He was a doctor. He was, you know, Ray had resurfaced. So, I'm still intrigued with Ray, and I'm not finished with him yet.
So Sylvester, you know, you say you're not done with him yet, and yet, you know, I was reading a column that you compiled in this book. This is from the year 2000, when you were writing about Uncle Ray. This is in Take Five magazine, the magazine you started. Here's a quote, and this is what you are telling him in this column. You say, more and more whites are talking about diversity and saying they want to tackle racism for once and for all. A few of them are even showing up at protest rallies to speak against you and calling for your demise, and you're telling Uncle Ray this is a sign of hope. Well, Ray just laughs and points out it's all part of his plan, that these same whites are siphoning away tax dollars from the city for their lofts and their high rises, even as black folks are, quote, sent packing. This was crazy to read that you wrote this in the year 2000. It feels like something a columnist could write this exact same column about St. Louis in 2021. Do you feel like in some ways nothing has changed here?
That's very observant of you, Sarah. Yeah. When I was reading that again, I was like, man, This could be written, you know, in 2014, 2015, 2020, because Ray is still very, very powerful, and in many ways, he's elusive. He's there, but he's not there. So the heartbreaking part about this for me, Sarah, is that I'm 63. My children, my grandchildren, and my great-grandchildren will be dealing with the issues that I dealt with, my father dealt with, and my grandfather dealt with. And that, to me, is just heartbreaking.
Do you see St. Louis making any progress with its Uncle Ray problem?
Oh, my God, that's a loaded question. on the surface, yes, there are more black folks in power, more black folks in politics, more black folks in influential positions. On that level, yes. But on another level, on I think the most important level, we have got work to do ourselves. You know, I'm happy that Trump is out of office. I'm happy that Joe Biden is our president. But if nothing else, President Trump and the pandemic expose all of the vulnerabilities of being black. And all those things are still with us today. So until we decide collectively, and I'm not talking about revolution, until we decide collectively that we are going to go back and control our neighborhoods, control our schools, control our own economic destiny, we're going to always be in this victim role. And St. Louis doesn't make that easy, because the powers that be, the movers and shakers, are still thinking, how do I build the next big project downtown? How do I build the next big development for rich developers? It still has that mindset of 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, going back to Port Igoe. So until we decide, and we need our black politicians to up the ante, until we decide that we are going to control our own destiny socially, economically, politically, we're going to always be trailing. Mm-hmm. And I see St. Louis way behind other cities in this arena.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you mentioned COVID-19 there, because you are back to being a columnist again. You're in the pages of the St. Louis American, and you're there on, it's a one-year fellowship, and you're there to chronicle the effects of the pandemic on the Black community. This has been, it's been great to see what you do with this beat. You've brought so many interesting voices in. Every week there's somebody who brings a new perspective. What's the bigger picture look like to you? Is the Black community weathering what's been such a terrible storm?
Well, thank you. I'm not really a columnist. I'm actually a COVID writer. My beat is COVID's impact on the Black community. But what I've been trying to do is approach the job from a narrative standpoint, telling stories about people. So in that regard, I got to say, I am very, very inspired. You know, from the guy who determined to keep his bar open, KJ's, you know, by any means necessary, to the doctors who I've talked to, and some of them, like I did one, there's one in today's paper. She's a great, in the middle of this pandemic, she had a baby during the pandemic, but she has a wonderful sense of humor. And she's an infectious disease doctor. She's been working on this since the AIDS crisis in the 80s. But she has a wonderful sense of humor and a beautiful outlook. So people I've talked to from, you know, the street level to the academic level to the medical level have all been inspiring to me. You know, they're all doing their thing, facing this pandemic and trying to survive, coming up with ways to do things. They're creative. So yeah, it's been a great beat for me. Not only because it's inspiring, but it's been a chance to flex my narrative muscle, to go in there and find a story. You know, I could do statistics and quotes, but I really want to know about the person. Who are you? What makes you tick? What bothers you? What makes you cry at night? What makes you keep going? That's been challenging for me, but it's also been very rewarding. Everything seems to be falling in place. I don't know where this thing is going, but it seems like, you know, the universe is working with me.
Well, it does feel like that, and it feels like, I mean, man, you know, these, you don't want to call them columns, even though they kind of feel like columns to me. These pieces just, they bring us such a portrait of resilience, and it's hard to imagine when this 1 year is up, you're going to be ready to give up that beat. Do you want to keep doing this kind of writing on such a regular basis?
I do. I enjoy it, and I don't know if the Deaconess Foundation is going to re-up and do it again, or if the Americans can find another way to do it, but yeah, I really, really enjoy it. You know, I'm getting up there, and I want to end my life, you know, in the Walter Mosley lane. You know, I want to be writing novels and, you know, a series of novels. And so it seems like this particular job is also preparing me for that.
I think that's absolutely right. And man, this is your second book out now. I see the third is going to be a novel. Sylvester Brown, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Sarah, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And Sylvester Brown's new book is White Castles with Jesus and Uncle Ray at the Used Tire Shop. We have a link on our website where you can get a copy yourself. And before we say goodbye today, a reminder that we always welcome your questions and comments. That might be a recommendation for someone to interview, a personal story you'd like to share, or in the case of this caller, a suggestion of how we can best serve our community.
This is Barbie Anderson. I live in Southwest City, and in listening to all the updates via commercial radio and television as well as KWMU, I am struck by the idea that contact information and update information on the COVID-19 vaccines never includes a way to call on by phone. You know, part of my frustration with this is that it always leaves out a group of people who don't have either, and it's often the poor people or older people. And no wonder they're at the end of the line when it comes to getting any kind of benefits.
So thank you to Barb Anderson for bringing this issue to our attention. And if you're a resident of St. Louis City and you would prefer to schedule a COVID-19 vaccine appointment by phone, you should call the city's health department hotline. Get your pen and paper ready, because Barb has that number for you.
The number is 657-1499, the city health department's COVID hotline, 657-1499.
And that is 314-657-1499. Now, for St. Louis County residents, the number to call is 314-615-2660. That's 314-615-2660. Illinois residents can reach that state's hotline at 1-800-889-3931. That's 1-800-889-3931. Now, suffice to say, getting a vaccine is likely to be a whole different hurdle, even after you call these numbers. But those are the numbers to sign up. And again, we want to say thank you to Barb for putting that issue on our radar and also pointing us towards those numbers. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Evie Hempel, Lara Hamden, Emily Woodbury, and Alex Hoyer. The audio engineer is Aaron Dorr. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. That's 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening and have a happy weekend. I'm Sarah Fenske.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, honoring Arbor Day on April 26th, with an ongoing commitment to sustainable stewardship and conservation of Missouri's forests. ChooseWood.com.